Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
It was located on the corner of 35th and Shields, and for 80 years, it was the very heart of the South Side of Chicago. Beginning in 1910 and continuing through the Roaring Twenties and into the Great Depression and World War II, and through the Civil Rights Movement and Disco Demolition Night, Comiskey Park was the epicenter of everything that went on Chicago's South Side. All of that came to an end in 1990 when Comiskey Park, dubbed the Baseball Palace of the World, was the home of the Chicago White Sox for one final season. In that season, despite baseball insiders predicting that the Chi Sox would finish the season in last place in the American League West, the White Sox battled with the defending World Series champion Oakland A's for most of the season and gave the venerable old ballpark one last great summer of baseball. Hello, I'm Dana Augusta, and you're listening to the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, the sports history podcast you didn't know you needed. In this all-new episode of the podcast, I sit down with Ken Smoller talking about his new book, Last Comiskey, chronicling the 1990 Chicago White Sox season with the backdrop of their final year in the Classic Baseball Stadium. Also in this episode, we'll take a look at this year's NBA playoff field through the lens of history. The Celtics are looking for the 18th NBA title, while the Denver Nuggets are eyeing for their second consecutive NBA crown. Meanwhile, teams like the Phoenix Suns, the LA Clippers, Minnesota Timberwolves, and Oklahoma City Thunder are looking to hoist the Larry O'Brien for their first time. Later in the show, in our shout-out segment, I'll take you on a personal trip back to my teenage years and the instances I visited Wrigley Field and the new Comiskey Park, both were memorable moments in my life and the origin of my love for baseball. That and so much more in this new episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about the sports yesteryear, and so we're pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings sports history to life. The Row One gallery features over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, and advertisements in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. Any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. It's your choice! In the Row One shop, you can pick from thousands of unique items that feature retro and historical backgrounds dating back to 1876. We have everything from clothing to phone cases to mugs, even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1 for access to the full Row One catalog. When you buy from the gallery today, you can instantly save 15% on your purchase. All you have to do is enter the code SHN15 and your discount will be applied. That's SHN15. That's it. Simple. Save 15% off all your prints in the Row One gallery. Just go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. And don't forget to check out all the podcasts on the Sports History Network. Soundtrack provided by Kevin McLeod of filmmusic.io.
And we're back, and you're listening to the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a proud member of the Sports History Network. Now, when you think of classic ballparks in the history of Major League Baseball, you think of the original Yankee Stadium, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later on, the Polo Grounds, Tiger Stadium, Shibe Park, and of course you think about the current ones of Fenway Park and Wrigley Field. But somehow, Comiskey Park kind of gets lost. But Comiskey Park had been the site of so many magical and wonderful and incredible games for the Chicago White Sox, which was their home for 80 years. Beginning in 1910, on the corner of 35th and Shields, it was the heart of the South Side. A new book coming that's out now by Ken Smoller called Last Comiskey. It chronicles the final baseball season at the venerable old park, what was known once as the Baseball Palace of the World in the summer of 1990. Ken, glad to have you aboard. Thank you for joining me. How are you doing today?
Doing fantastic. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, let's talk about the book itself. I mean, what inspired you to write this book?
It actually all happened way back in 1990 itself. I, as a sophomore in college at the time, or going into sophomore year, decided that I wanted to photograph every nook and cranny of that ballpark before it was demolished. I was just learning to become a photographer in the last few years of the park and was a college photographer in Michigan at the time, and really wanted to have for my own memories, but I kind of thought at some point maybe this could turn into a book. Fast forward 33 years, Matt Flesh, a first-time documentarian, put out a call for photos and videos of Old Comiskey Park. I gladly shared mine with him. When I saw how great the documentary turned out, I convinced Matt that we need to turn it into a book to give not just Sox fans, but baseball fans and ballpark fans something to kind of look at and keep track of and, you know, have on their shelves to go back and remember this really beautiful, amazing ballpark. So that's how it all came together. Last year after the documentary came out, we made this decision, and it's been a labor of love revisiting that old ballpark in the late 80s, early 90s.
You know, as we were talking, you know, right before we came on, we were talking about the time I had spent some time in Chicago during that time period. In fact, the very first Major League Baseball game I had ever attended was at Wrigley Field. You know, don't prosecute me too hard on that. But
as long as you rooted for the other team.
No, actually, that was the very first time I had ever gone to a Major League Baseball game. It was at Wrigley Field. Yeah. And it was an amazing experience. And the next season, and 2 years later in 91, I attended a White Sox game in the new park. But I was actually around seeing the old park being torn down. And it never really resonated with me or how important Comiskey Park was to not only White Sox fans, but fans around that area of Chicago in the South Side. What was it for people that lived on the South Side? What did that park mean to them?
Well, unlike the North Side, which has a whole host of different places of gatherings, theaters and sporting venues and whatnot, there's not as much in the modern South Side as the North Side. So there was a lot of pride in that ballpark. And it wasn't just the White Sox. The Chicago Cardinals played there, now the Arizona Cardinals. For more years than any other venue, they played their games at Comiskey Park. The Chicago Sting soccer team played there for a while. And the Chicago American Giants of the Negro League played there for many years. And given the fact that that part of town had a huge African-American population, that was when the stadium was most full, especially for the East-West All-Star Game.
That's right.
Which took place every summer, starting about the same time as the regular All-Star Game. That park was overfilled. I've seen reports where there were standing room only and people sneaking in to get to the games because all the stars would come home. So that was, for Chicago, the one real big place of congregation where everyone could get together. And unlike their brethren to the north, you had folks from all over, all walks of life at Comiskey Park. And that was something that was special about that. It really represented Chicago, but also represented true baseball fans, not just the tourists who wanted to see the pretty ivy and the lovely neighborhood of Wrigley Field, but baseball fans who came to see real baseball in a real ballpark. It was a lot like Tiger Stadium, but it doesn't get the recognition. Although I'd argue it's a prettier stadium, prettier ballpark with the arches and how elegantly it was constructed. But it was a really important place. Ironically, I lived 39 miles the other way, but that was just where my dad took me as a kid, and I fell in love early.
Now, that's one of the things, whenever I think of Comiskey Park, and I think in my mind's eye, I think of those arches that's in the mm-hmm. you know, the outfield wall, you know, where the stands are. And I think of that, and I think of, you know, the green seats and the yellow painted, you know, box railings around it. Mm-hmm. I think of that. That comes to mind right away. And of course, you had the exploding scoreboard, you know, installed by Bill Veeck. You think of all of those things, and of course you think of the East West game of the Negro Leagues played there every year, and it was standing room only, like you said, you know. And the park itself, you know, you said that you were a photographer there, you took pictures of it, so obviously that park as a person means a lot to you.
It sure did. I mean, it was the first place that I ever went to a sporting event when I was 7 years old. I fell in love with the scoreboard. You know, I didn't care as much about the White Sox winning then. I cared about seeing fireworks go out of that scoreboard, hearing Nancy Faust, the famous organist who played 41 years for the White Sox, playing Na 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 Na, Hey Hey Goodbye, and hearing everyone sing. And Harry Carey at the time was a White Sox broadcaster and did the seventh inning stretch there well before he was doing it at Wrigley and became trendy. And with that whole collection of feeling that made me appreciate the gathering of a sporting event, and you know, just hearing everyone get together and being behind the same goal. Granted, it was a lot of times only 7, 10, 15,000 fans, but they were loud in that old ballpark. And it was also where I learned to take photographs. I didn't become a professional photographer for my career, but I've always done it ever since college, back when I was at Michigan, taking photos of the Fab Five and Desmond Howard. And that's where I really learned how to take pictures. I brought my old 110 Kodak camera when I was a little kid for a photo day, when the players would come around the perimeter of the infield and take photos for all of us. And it was a real special place. You know, the Sox fans that I've encountered, not just Sox fans, but baseball fans all across the country, all have a reverence for that ballpark because it represented baseball in its real purest form. And it's been great. I've been seeing book sales all from throughout the country, which makes me really excited to think that either there's the Sox fan, White Sox fan diaspora, or just that people appreciate that ballpark and really want to remember it. It was a place that had a lot of history to it.
Now, your book, the name of it, once again, Last Comiskey. The book itself chronicles the last season of that ballpark, which was 1990, and also chronicles the team. I watched the documentary earlier today, and you talk about brought back a lot of memories and a lot of guys from that White Sox team that I totally forgot about. But that was an amazing team. And not only was it an amazing team, that year, 1990, they literally came out of nowhere to be a contender in the AL West. They were part of the AL West back then because there was only two divisions in 1990. They were battling it out the whole season pretty much with the Oakland A's. They were the defending World Series champions, if I'm not mistaken. And they were neck and neck with the A's for most of the season, despite the fact that a lot of the prognosticators predicted the White Sox to finish dead last in the AL West that year. You know, talk about that team and some of the great players that was on that team and the manager, Jeff Torborg.
Well, Jeff Torborg, first of all, was fantastic. Just a real down-to-earth guy. You could tell it through interviews, but I got a chance to meet him late in the season when I had a press pass. Just a down-to-earth guy. And what he did is he allowed all those guys to basically play the way they wanted to play and brought them up. He had a lot of young guys, because for 4 years in a row, the White Sox scouting system produced number one picks that kept coming up and starting right away. You had Jack McDowell, you had Robin Ventura, two of whom played in the College World Series against each other. I think Robin Ventura was named the College Baseball Player of the Decade. Then you had Alex Fernandez. And then to cap it all off, you had young Frank Thomas, who started his career in August of 1990 in a game in Milwaukee. And instantly you could see that he was someone special. On top of that, another special player for his speed, in particular his triples and stolen bases, was young Sammy Sosa, who at that point in time was not known for power. I think he had maybe a dozen, 15 home runs. He was a quick guy. He once had two triples in a game. He could cut a ball off in the outfield. He was he had great Jerry curls that day, that look. And, you know, he didn't speak a lot of English, so he didn't do a lot of interviews at the time. But he was also part of that team. You kind of wonder what could have happened if those five guys had stayed together and had there not been the strike in 94, what could have happened? You know, they really were a solid team. Sadly, Sosa got traded for George Bell and a pack of donuts or something. Yeah. And went on to do what he did up north. But and then you still had some old players. You had Carlton Fisk was still going strong at that point and bringing along the new pitchers. You had Bobby Thigpen breaking the single season save record of Dennis Eckersley, a record that lasted until I think K-Rod broke it maybe 18, 20 years later. Ozzie Guillen, who would later become the first Latin American manager to win the World Series, and most importantly, to break the 88-year curse of the White Sox.
Yes, yes.
And Shoeless Joe. So it really was a special team. You had just all kinds of players. You had Ron Kittle, who had come back for his final stint with the White Sox, who had been a rookie star in 1983. Just a whole host of characters.
Now, you had made mention of the 1983 team, and it was somewhat ironic that the manager of the 83 team was Tony La Russa, and they battled the Oakland A's with La Russa at the helm that whole season of 1990. And I watched the documentary, and there's a good bit about it is Ozzie Guillen, and they made a Ozzie Guillen was essentially the leader of that team. It was essentially a young team, but it had like some really gritty veteran players mixed in. But Ozzie Guillen was essentially the leader of that team, the leader in that clubhouse.
He was named co-captain with Carlton Fisk by manager Jeff Torborg. And they'd never had captains. I don't recall them having captains since then. But he was named as captain at the age of maybe 27, 26. You know, barely speaking English still, or speaking kind of a combo. He came up in 1985 as part of, and your listeners may recall this, the Lamar Hoyt trade to the San Diego Padres. And the key to that trade for the White Sox was getting Ozzie Guillen. And he, you know, he was everywhere. He had key hits, key defensive plays, stolen base when you needed it. He yelled at players in their face whenever they weren't playing as hard as they needed to be. You know, Ozzie wrote the foreword to the book. I had to clean up a few of the swears. I left most of them in there. you don't go too many sentences without a swear from Ozzie in one of the two languages. You know, he was a real important part of that player. The crazy part was that he was a co-captain with Carlton Fisk, who couldn't be more different. But the two of them together really brought that team along. They got within a few games of the A's in the August stretch of the season and then had a disastrous series against the Angels. And just the A's went on a roll. The A's picked up new players late in the season. They picked up star Harold Baines, former White Sox player, just to kind of rub salt into the wounds of the White Sox fans. I think that Willie McGee also joined the team. And you know, they were unstoppable. They also, as Ozzie points out in the documentary and we repeat in the book, they were doing some illegal shit as well. So I'm quoting Ozzie there. So, you know, we didn't know about it till later, but they were heavily juicing.
Well, I mean, Ozzie Guillen, I mean, just to stick on it for one more second, Ozzie, to me, is one of the most important White Sox people in the history of that franchise as a player, manager, leading them to the World Series championship in 05. He just seems like he was like the perfect person to go to that White Sox team. If I've been following the White Sox ever since that time. And there's a reason why I became somewhat of a White Sox fan. I'm gonna tell you later, and I'm gonna give you two dates that were important for me that really led me to that. And you know, Ozzie Guillen was a shortstop, but he was a very fiery, as you said, and he brought that, and that was part of his managerial style as well.
Yeah, and by the way, today he is now doing broadcasting post-game, and he is the soul of the White Sox fan base, just dealing with the pain of what's going on. You know, he is White Sox through and through.
Right.
There's so many different stages of Ozzie, and I actually, when I first interviewed him, I said to him, I go, if there's a White Sox Mount Rushmore, if not a Chicago Mount Rushmore, you are arguably on it. You're definitely on the White Sox Mount Rushmore. You know, he was an important player for 13 seasons. He was the link from the old ballpark to the new ballpark. He, by the way, did not like the old ballpark at the time. Now he looks back on it much more fondly.
Yeah.
You know, he was a key person on the team for what was a really solid team and sadly did not win the World Series in the 90s. And then to come back and manage that great team, those pitchers, to have the strength to let four pitchers get complete games in the ALCS in 2005 is crazy in this day and age. To have that much trust in your pitching staff, I think they had one or two innings of relief in the entire ALCS against the Angels that year. You know, he's so important. He brought together a very diverse team from players all throughout the world. He got them all on the same page. He drags attention of the media and puts it on himself, which he kind of likes. And he is an old school baseball guy in many ways, has a couple newfangled ideas, but he is like an old school guy. He reminds me almost of, you know, the manager on the Knights and the Natural. He has a look like him, but he's got that kind of personality. And he's just an absolute pleasure. I couldn't have been more honored that he agreed to have his be the foreword to my book. It was such an honor growing up watching him and watching his kids on the field. But Frank Thomas is obviously probably the most important White Sox ever, at least the best. But it's really a strong case that Ozzie Guillen is the most important man ever to play to the White Sox or be, you know, part of the White Sox system in his entire career.
Now, I'm going to give you a couple of dates during the 1990 season. And to me, this was important, for at least from my perspective. July 2nd, they unveil new uniforms. Now, before, they had the White Sox with just the script written across with the curly cues on the ball caps, and they bring out these new black and silver pinstriped uniforms. Mm-hmm. And as a kid growing up in Louisiana, I was 17 years old. When they showed these, me and my best friend was watching SportsCenter when they showed it. We both looked at those, and we looked at each other, and we said almost simultaneously, I'm getting one of those.
Yeah.
And I got the white with the black pinstripes because I thought that was so cool. He was like, I'm getting the black one, the black alternate uniform. Yep. Right before opening day, we show up to school. We were seniors in high school. We show up to school the day of opening day. I'm wearing the white with the black pinstripes and he's wearing the black alternate. Everybody was looking at us like, where did you get those? Because I want one. You know, that was just, you got to understand that's like a throwback in a way, because just the color scheme was different from the uniform they wore when they won the pennant in 59, the go-go
Correct.
You know, but instead of it being red and black, it was black and silver. And those were so, so cool.
You know, it's weird. At the time, I was so excited about it. I hated the uniforms that they were wearing. They were boring.
Yeah, they were. They were
supposed to be throwbacks, but they really weren't. I remember feeling almost a little cynical when they came out. Like, I know they're trying to take advantage of the Raiders' popularity, but it was so damn cool that I didn't care. They debuted them, if you recall, Ozzie and Fisk went across the street into the construction zone and they modeled those new uniforms. There's a cool baseball card. I think it was Upper Deck. You can see it. Look for it on eBay or something. And I remember coming out and all of a sudden I would start to see Sox hats everywhere I went. I was at the time, as I mentioned, doing photography for the Michigan Daily, the newspaper. And I was going to all the Big Ten campuses and got to, you know, cover the Fab Five. So I was traveling around and I'd see Sox hats everywhere. You didn't see that. You didn't see them in Chicago. No. You saw Cub hats everywhere. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it became part of the hip hop community. And then that went to another level. There's a great documentary the Sox put out recently for the anniversary of those hats. The Sox, along with, I think it was New Era. I reference it in the book. And they talked about how important that was to the hip hop community, where there's like a style, a baseball style, and created the throwback look. And everyone was into throwbacks, because now you took an old style uniform, as you said, from the 50s, but you made it cool. And that really launched the trend. Now, what was really interesting is they did another throwback that year.
And that's the next date I was getting to.
Yeah, that I was super jazzed for. Turn back the clock day. And it's from, based on my research, no other team had done this. They threw tickets up for 50 cents for general admission. And that was about half of the ballpark. They wore 1917 style uniforms, but with modern clothing. They turned off all the electricity for the PA system, for the scoreboard. Nancy Faust, the organist, walked around with an accordion. Gene Honda, who's still the announcer, fans would know him. He's the announcer for the NCAA Final Four as well. Mm-hmm. He was walking around with a megaphone. The Brewers, for some reason, a modern team, you know, they're the Brewers / Pilots, wore their regular uniforms. And it was just a really awesome experience. That was the cool hat before we saw what was going to be the new hat, the black hat.
Yeah.
And the sad thing about it is the White Sox blew a 9-0 lead against the Brewers and lost 12-9 in extras, which I remember just being miserable on the ride home. That was the game, by the way, where Sammy Sosa, I think, had two triples, if my memory serves correct. But that changed baseball, fashion, sports. You know, you wouldn't have these alternate uniforms these days of retro all throughout the world, really, without seeing that popularity. Whoever was, I think it may have been Rob Gallas, who worked for the front office at the time, who came up with the idea. It was brilliant. It was done on an important anniversary for the ballpark. And it really led to that whole throwback era. And you know, just was a fun part of that season. You know, at the time we didn't know the team was going to be any good. So the Sox had a lot of promotions that were trying to get people into the ballpark and really focused on the history of the park to get people to enjoy that final season. Then lo and behold, it became so good that people just wanted to go to be part of that season, be around that team.
And what was also what made it kind of cool when they had to turn back the clock day on July 11th against the Brewers is that it wasn't too long after the movie Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It wasn't too long after that. And you had the whole thing with Shoeless Joe and Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner. And that's what the uniforms that that Ray Liotta and the rest of his teammates wore in the cornfield was those uniforms. And I think that's kind of what added to that. Was that Field of Dreams came out, I think, maybe a year earlier, a couple years earlier.
1 year earlier. And then before that was Eight Men Out.
That's right.
Which has had a similar uniform. And then they brought out those uniforms again at the Field of Dreams game in 2021.
Yeah.
Which turned out to be one of my most amazing memories of White Sox baseball in all my years of watching. Seeing Tim Anderson hit that what they now call the stalk-off home run, wearing those cool old duds. You know, it was finally nice to see those uniforms win something since 1917. But they had such bad luck in the 1990 game. But, yeah, those were cool. I was kind of hoping that they were going to bring those out as the new uniforms. And then when we saw what they designed, you know, it's proof of how good of a design it was that still to this day, it's one of the number one selling uniforms. However, the team absolutely is horrific. I mean, no one is there. No, there are very few players that fans are following around the country, but people love those uniforms still.
Now, the next season, they move into the brand new park, which was named New Comiskey. And since then, they've gone on to several different name changes, as most modern stadiums do now with naming rights and whatever have you. What was your initial thoughts of the new park?
First of all, one thing I want to say is Sox fans do not call it by the corporate names. They still call it Comiskey or Sox Park.
Okay.
I consciously, in my book, only once did I use a corporate name. It was because of a quote. We still call it Comiskey. It was bland. You were removed from the players in a lot of ways. So when you walked around Old Comiskey, and the way old stadiums used to work is you walked underneath the stands on the concourse. So the locker room, the players had to go through the concourse to get to their locker rooms from the parking lots. You know, you saw kind of everyone mingled in. Now, modern stadiums, you have a service level, and then the first level happens. And so you're insulated from them. It was filled with concrete. It was bland. It had no character. It was sanitary. I mean, it felt too clean. You had that 80 years of hot dog smell and onions and popcorn and beer and everything else that it felt like a ballpark. And you just didn't get that in the new one. The upper deck, the first row of the upper deck was further away than the last row of the lower deck of Old Comiskey.
Yeah.
Now, sure, you had a lot of beams and that was a problem. But the problem now is the beams go underneath an upper deck and they push it further into the sky and further back, coupled with club level and two levels of skyboxes, and you're just so far away from the field, and it doesn't have that atmosphere. The sound dissipates, and it doesn't have the character of the old ballparks. There are some new ballparks that have captured that, PNC Park in particular, but very few remain. You know, if you ever get a chance, you got to get to, like, feels like Rickwood in Birmingham was one of the last ones that remains that still feels that way. Obviously, Fenway and Wrigley have been updated. There are a handful of old minor league ballparks, Engel in Chattanooga, a few other ones. But that feel you just don't get at the new parks.
You know, you got to take into consideration that was the last major league ballpark built before Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Before it brought in that new retro style. That was the last one built before that.
Yeah,
so I think story. Just looking at it, they might have tried to do that, but just didn't quite get it, you know. But nothing could beat the old park. Nothing can beat it.
No.
Is there any other projects that you may be working on to close out? Is there any other projects that you may be working on
as of right now? I run a sports travel blog called Stadium Vagabond. It's stadiumvagabond.com or at stadiumvagabond on social media. And what I do is I write and take photographs of sports from throughout the world to try to share what it is like to go in a soccer game in Europe or a baseball game in Mexico, or, you know, show people what it's like to see the new SoFi Stadium. And, you know, I give my reviews and tie it to the history of the old parks and stadiums that previously were the homes of the Rams or the Chargers. So that's what I'm working on as well. The book has taken up so much time. And then my next book is going to be one about all the stadiums in Chicago, current and in the past, for all the sports.
Oh, wow.
Because Chicago has a great history of venues. You know, Wrigley, you have Soldier Field. Chicago Stadium. You've got Old Ryan Field, which just got torn down last week.
Yeah, I just saw that, yes.
Yeah, the last vestige was there. The old auditorium. You know, there's so much history with the Chicago Stadiums. Then you throw the universities all throughout the state. So that'll be my next project that I'm going to work on after moving beyond Comiskey. But for now, it's been a thrill to relive these memories of Old Comiskey Park.
And, well, Ken, it was a very pleasure talking to you, and much success to you. And once again, the book, the name of it, once again, Last Comiskey, talks about the 1990 Chicago White Sox during the final year of Comiskey Park, which was one of the great, great old-time ballparks in Major League Baseball. Ken, thank you for joining me once again.
Thanks for having me. I just want to mention the website for the book is lastcomiskeybook.com. It's lastcomiskeybook.com. Thanks so much for having me. Absolutely great to talk about Old Comiskey.
Coming up after a short timeout, we're going to take a look through the scope of history, this year's NBA playoff field. In this, the 2024 edition of the NBA playoffs, it is filled with equal parts of traditional NBA powers, with new teams, with new stars. And we here at the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, we will go through this year's NBA playoffs and highlight every team's postseason and championship history. Once again, you're listening to the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
We here at the Sports History Network proudly partner with 26 podcasts, all revolving around the history of sports. But did you know that many of our hosts were sports history authors way before they started their shows? It's true. We've got Joe Ziemba, host of When Football Was Football. Joe Zagurski, host of Pro Football in the 1970s. Mark Morthier, host of Yesterday Sports. Tommy Phillips, host of Lombardi Memories. And Scott Adamson, co-host of From the 55-Yard Line. All these authors have many books for you to choose from. To check them out, go to our website at sportshistorynetwork.com/sportshistorybooks. Pick up your copy today! Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
Welcome back to Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network. And just a reminder out there, you can follow us on Twitter or X or Twitter X, whichever you prefer. You can follow us at HistoricallySP2. And you could also write the show with possible show ideas, or if you just want to say hello, you could write us at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. One more time, that's historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And now, back to the show. Now, looking at the NBA, after 82 games and numerous twists and turns during the season, the NBA has reached its postseason. Along with the usual suspects that normally reach the NBA playoffs, there are several teams that have made the postseason for the first time in several years, adding a little spice to the playoff field and adding to the exciting nature of the NBA playoffs. Now, there's one notable exception to this, and that's the Golden State Warriors. Even with future Hall of Famer Steph Curry, the Warriors failed to make the playoffs for the first time in 3 years since the 2021 season. And after the new play-in tournament, which, to be completely honest, I really liked, despite the fact that I was initially lukewarm to it at best when it was first suggested. 8 teams in the Eastern Conference and Western Conference will battle for the Larry O'Brien Trophy to be given out in mid-June. Now, starting in the Eastern Conference, you have the top-seeded Boston Celtics taking on their most recent rival, the Miami Heat. The Celtics enter the playoffs with the best record in the NBA and the number one overall seed. Meanwhile, the Heat entered this year's postseason undermanned, maybe an understatement. Miami is without Jimmy Butler and injured with an injured knee, and also without former Celtic Terry Rozier. However, as a Celtic fan, I'm still concerned with the quote unquote Heat culture, which propelled them to the NBA Finals a year ago. As of recording this, the Celtics behind Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and surprise star of the series, Derek White, the Celtics are one game away from advancing closer to the championship banner number 18. However, the Celtics' last season against Miami in the Eastern Finals became only the fourth team in NBA postseason history to force a Game 7 after being down 3-0. Now, the Celtics are up 3-1. Who's to say that the Heat may do the same thing to them as they did last year? Who knows? It's Heat culture. The winner of that series will face the winner of the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Orlando Magic.
Then there's always one series, especially in the East, that's always relegated to be the de facto forgotten Eastern Conference series, which most of their games take place on NBA TV. And as it seems every year, it goes seven games and is often very entertaining. And once again, it goes seven games, but people don't really watch it or talk about it. In this case, for this year, it's the Magic versus the Cavaliers. Now, Cleveland is in the postseason for the second consecutive year after a five-year absence. This came after the Cavaliers reached the NBA Finals four straight seasons, winning it all in 2016. Meanwhile, Orlando, the fifth seed in the East, is in the postseason for the first time in 4 years and is looking to win their first ever NBA title. The Magic had reached the NBA Finals in two occasions in 1995, led by Shaquille O'Neal and Penny Hardaway, and then once again led by Dwight Howard in 2010. Meanwhile, in Milwaukee, despite a season of turmoil, the Bucks are back in the playoffs and not without some trepidation by fans and media. When the season began, the Bucks were looked upon as the team that would push the Celtics during the season and would battle for the Eastern Conference Championship, recalling their deep-seated rivalry during the 1980s. Yet, with a myriad of injuries to its stars, most notably Damian Lillard and Giannis Antetokounmpo, and plus a mid-season coaching change, the Bucks have the most questions they're headed into this NBA playoffs. The Bucks are looking to win his third NBA title in franchise history, their second in 4 years. Yet the team they're facing in their are their division rival, the Indiana Pacers. At the time of this recording, the Pacers hold a 3-2 lead in the series and have a chance to eliminate these shorthanded Bucks in Indianapolis. The Pacers have a lot of young stars and is a team on the rise. And unlike the Pacers from the 1990s, this team is predicated on offense, I should say. One of the highest scoring teams in the NBA this season, which makes them actually more in common with their NBA ABA championship teams in 1970, 72, and 73. Speaking of 1973, that was the last year the New York Knicks won the NBA title. The Knicks are the second seed in the East and is looking to get back to the NBA Finals since the strike-shortened year of 1999. Tuesday night, the Knicks had a chance to party like it was 1999 when they had a lead heading into the final seconds of regulation, only to give up that lead and eventually lose in overtime at Madison Square Garden. The year 1999 was the last time the Knicks won a series clinching game at home. Well, if they want to still party like Prince, they have to win it in Game 7. Something that Knicks fans are actually scared to death of. Speaking of the Knicks, their last NBA title came in 1973, as I mentioned before, where they defeated the Lakers in the finals only after getting past the Boston Celtics that won 69 games that year and is considered the greatest Celtic team of all time that never won a title. Facing them in the first round is another team that I consider a NBA blue blood, and that's the Philadelphia 76ers. The Sixers have been a perennial NBA postseason participant, but they haven't been to the finals since 2001. Their last championship was in 1983 with the likes of Dr. J, Moses Malone, Andrew Toney, and Mo Cheeks. This was the first time that the Sixers and Knicks have matched up in the postseason since 1989, when Patrick Ewing led the Knicks in a sweep over the Sixers that was led by Charles Barkley, and they won that series 3-0. Now, over in the Western Conference, you have the Oklahoma City Thunder. With an average age a shade under 24 years of age, it's the youngest team ever to have a number one seed in the NBA playoffs. It is their first postseason appearance, I should say, since 2020, and their 11th overall since moving from Seattle, and along with their youth, they have the loudest arena in the NBA on this side of Old Oracle Arena in Sacramento. Their opponent is the New Orleans Pelicans. Well, was the New Orleans Pelicans, which reached the postseason for only the second time in 3 seasons. The Thunder promptly swept the Ballers from the Big Easy in 4 games. And then there are the LA Clippers. The Clippers are in the playoffs once again and looking to erase their reputation of being a great regular season team that, thanks mostly to injuries
And like that famous line from Mission Impossible, this tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds, which the Clippers normally do in the postseason. Since their arrival in the NBA in 1970 as the Buffalo Braves, the Clippers are the oldest NBA team to have never reached the NBA Finals. Their opponent in the first round is another franchise that is all too familiar with postseason failure, the Dallas Mavericks. Prior to winning their only NBA title, the Mavericks had a similar reputation of not only losing in the postseason, but losing early in the playoffs to teams that on paper they were much better than. And their only title, ironically, came in 2011 in a mild upset, beating the Miami Heat when they had LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. Then there are the Phoenix Suns. Well, there were the Phoenix Suns. The Suns were not only the oldest team in the NBA without a championship, but they are the winningest team in all of North American professional team sports without a title. If you look back at their history, it is hard to believe that they never won. Reaching the finals in 1976 with Paul Westphal, Curtis Perry, Dick Van Orsdale, and Alvin Adams. And then again in 1993 with the aforementioned Charles Barkley. Along with him, there was Dan Majerle, Kevin Johnson, and Danny Ainge. And once again in 2021. Yet, they had other great players that walked through the Valley of the Sun, such as Walter Davis, Mark West, Sean Marion, and of course, Steve Nash. While the Suns have been a playoff mainstay for the better part of a half a century, their opponent was the Minnesota Timberwolves, who have not been. In their 35 years in the NBA, the T-Wolves have only been out of the first round once prior to this year, and that was in 2004, when they reached the Western Conference Finals that year with Kevin Garnett, Sam Cassell, and Wally Szczerbiak. Now, the Wolves seem to be truly the team on the rise as they swept the Suns in the first round and will take on the defending champion Denver Nuggets in the conference semifinals. Rounding out the NBA playoff field is the Lakers. They faced off against the Nuggets. Now, before last season, the Nuggets had never defeated the Lakers in the playoffs. The Nuggets exercised that demon and a lot more as they went on to slay another by winning his first NBA title and becoming the second former ABA team to win an NBA title. And even though the Nuggets are the current wearers of the crown, the Lakers are the most decorated team in NBA history, behind the Celtics, of course. They currently are tied with the Celtics with 17 NBA titles and a league record 32 appearances in the finals. Even with the likes of LeBron and Anthony Davis, it was a difficult road for the Lakers just to reach the playoffs, much less beat the Nuggets, which was led by Jamal Murray's clutch plays in two of the games in this series. The Nuggets took with that another step towards winning back-to-back championships, something about a decade or so ago seemed improbable. And as the playoffs continue to evolve, there will be new stars and more heroic performances that will continually make the NBA playoffs one of the most anticipated events on the sports calendar. Coming up, to wind up the show, we're going to send a shout out to my teenage years in the 1980s. Earlier in the show, we talked to Ken Smoller about Comiskey Park in the summer of 1990. Now, during that same time, I had attended my first Major League Baseball games, and ironically, both of them were in Chicago. In our shout out segment of the program, I will tell the story of the time I attended a baseball game at historic Wrigley Field and then a couple of years later at the brand new Comiskey Park and the differences. That's coming up right here on the podcast you didn't know you needed. The Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about the sports yesteryear, and so we're pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings sports history to life. The Row One gallery features over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, and advertisements in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. Any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic or poster paper. It's your choice. In the Row One shop, you can pick from thousands of unique items that feature retro and historical backgrounds dating back to 1876. We have everything from clothing to phone cases to mugs, even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1 for access to the full Row One catalog. When you buy from the gallery today, you can instantly save 15% on your purchase. All you have to do is enter the code SHN15 and your discount will be applied. That's SHN15. That's it. Simple. Save 15% off all your prints in the Row One Gallery. Just go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. And don't forget to check out all the podcasts on the Sports History Network. Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
To finish out this episode of the podcast, we will return to the Chicago baseball theme of the show and go back to not only some sports history, but to some personal history of my own. Now, every final segment of the show, we send a shout out to a particular person or team or memorable sports moment that for some fans, they've either forgotten about or never heard of or possibly slipped through the cracks of time. And in this case, it's sports related, but at the same time, it was a seminal moment of my life. It was the summer of 1989. Yours truly was 16 years old, and that summer, my family was planning a trip to Chicago to visit my godfather and his family. Now, to be honest, as a family, we would go on some road trips every now and then. I'm from South Louisiana, and the furthest we would normally go would be the semi-annual trips to Port Arthur, Texas, or Houston, and sometime the random trip to New Orleans. Yet, going to Chicago seemed as if we were going to another planet. And to be honest, sitting in the car with my parents and my sister for a 15-hour drive and still somehow remaining on planet Earth seems ridiculous. But we got to Chicago in one piece, and the experience of someone who grew up in New Iberia, Louisiana, with a population of roughly 20,000 people, was both eye-opening and exciting. And there I realized that some people like the big city life and but some also prefer the slow, peaceful life of small town living. Well, at the age of 16, put me down for the big city life. I hung up with my godfather's wife's younger relatives, went to a couple of parties, made new friends, and they were intrigued by where I was from and my then heavy South Louisiana accent that I no longer have. We were there for about a week, and towards the end of that week, my dad, godfather, and I were shopping, and there were some shoes in this one particular store that I really, really wanted. But my godfather, Eddie Brooks, who has actually appeared as a guest here on a podcast back in season one, convinced me to save my money because we were going somewhere later that week, and I was going to need some money to go there. So later that week ended up being Friday, July 21st, 1989. That morning was overcast and, for me, unusually cold. It had rained earlier that morning and the wind was coming off of Lake Michigan, and we really felt it because my godfather lived on the north side of Chicago. I got dressed and we left the house sometime around 10, and we took the train to our destination. Riding a train, or what they call the L, was a fascinating experience for me, once again, from a small town where everybody drove anywhere. There was no trains to speak of except freight. We reached our destination, and it seemed like it was just a random neighborhood I just saw a lot of people just milling around. I was confused. Where were we supposed to be going? I didn't see like any major stores or any type of landmark that would seem familiar, but then again, I'm in Chicago, nothing would seem familiar to me. But you know, it just seemed kind of weird being just in the middle of just random neighborhood. That was until we turned the corner from the train platform, and there it was. the famous red marquee for Wrigley Field. At that moment, my godfather looked at me and said, "That is why I wanted you to save your money." There it was, Wrigley Field. I had seen games on TV from there and numerous NFL films clips of the Bears when they played their home games there back in the day, but being there and seeing it with my own eyes was truly a treat. We had a few minutes before the game started, so we checked out several souvenir shops in and around the stadium in an area they called, of course, Wrigleyville. And for the first time in my life, I truly understood what it meant when people said they felt truly at home. Because Lord knows I felt truly at home there. This was the first Major League Baseball game I have ever attended. And to do it at Wrigley Field was really, really special. That afternoon, the Cubs were playing the San Francisco Giants, and ironically, these two teams were meet up in that year's National League Championship Series. The Cubs entered the day with a record of 51-44, 3.5 games behind the Montreal Expos, while the Giants were 58-38, 4 games ahead of second-place Houston Astros. The Giants got up to a 4-run lead and victimizing Cubs starter Rick Sutcliffe. Y'all remember Rick Sutcliffe? Well, anyway, yet the Cubs would make a game of it late, but in the end, the Giants would prevail 4-3. But I saw a game at Wrigley Field. I had no dog in the fight, but just being there was truly remarkable. And what really surprised me about that place was actually how small it was. I imagine that Major League Baseball fields were gigantic, yet the field itself was about the size of my high school's baseball field. Yet that day, I grabbed a couple of leaves of ivy from the fence and I heard Harry Carey sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." To me, that was heaven. I was a semi-baseball fan at the time. I kind of like watched it, I guess, out of self-defense. But that moment, at that exact moment, is when I really became a baseball fan for life. That was my first experience at a Major League Baseball game. The second one came 2 seasons later across town at brand new Comiskey Park. This would be the first season of the new Comiskey Park. We're talking summer 1991. And the new Comiskey Park, the one we talked about earlier, was in the process of being torn down, which was located literally across the street. And if I had had a camera, I would have definitely taken pictures of the grand old ballpark being knocked down. I gotta remember, I was 18 years old at the time and I really didn't have the sports history forethought I have now. At the time, all I wanted to do was go to the game and of course scope out some of the young ladies that called themselves White Sox fans or baseball fans in general. Now the difference between Wrigley Field and the new Comiskey Park, in the words of my college roommate Mark Adams, was like comparing steak to lunch meat. While Wrigley Field was drenched with history and tradition and the ivy-covered walls, the new Comiskey Park was sort of sterile and almost too clean to be a baseball park. Now, yeah, I do know that it was the very first summer of it being in operation and the newness was still in the air, but the ballpark itself had all the charm of a local supermarket. The game I attended there was on Tuesday night, June 18th, 1991. The Sox, 30-33 on the year, was taking on the then Cleveland Indians. Knuckleballer Charlie Huff was the starter for the White Sox and struggled for the first part of the game as the Indians led 4-2 heading into the bottom of the sixth. Then, with 3 White Sox on base, Chicago third baseman Robin Ventura blasted a grand slam over the right field fence, sending 30,000 White Sox fans into a frenzy and lighting the new exploding scoreboard in deep center field. In the end, Bobby Thigpen came in relief for Huff, and the White Sox claimed a 6-5 win that night over their longtime rivals from Northern Ohio. And talking to Smoller during the interview earlier in the episode caused me to reminisce about my 2 summers in Chicago, when I was just beginning to become a more knowledgeable baseball fan that also truly appreciated its history. Now, over the years, my love for baseball and its history has only grown and intensified. My thirst for knowledge for everything baseball history as well as Chicago's place in it has its origins on those two games in the late 80s and early 90s in the Windy City. And that will do it for this edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. And just a reminder, this podcast comes to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. I'd also like to send a heartfelt thank you to author Ken Smoller for coming on to talk to us about his book, Last Comiskey. You could pick it up at any bookstore that you may find within your area. To get more content of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, you could check us out on Twitter or X or Twitter X, whichever you prefer, at HistoricallySP2. Or you could send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, please, please subscribe to the show. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors. Hell, tell a passerby on the street about us if you think they like sports history. And until the next time I come at you, stay blessed, stay cool, and be your best in everything that you do. It'll make the world a much better place. Peace.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.